Okay, so we're back for, I believe, episode 84. 84. So, Joe, yes, how you doing?
I'm great, Tim. How well, actually, I just wanted to apologize, you know, before the show for my voice. I've had some kind of bioterrorism weapon got to me this week, and I've been recovering from it steadily, but I'm still a little less than normal. So in case I'm either more incoherent or less audible, that's why. But we're doing the best we can.
Okay. We persevere. Yes. Today I think we agreed to talk about free trade. Free trade is a concept, how it's been implemented. And of course, free trade is a trade policy. This is, of course, according to Wikipedia. For the most part, free trade is a trade policy that does not restrict imports or exports. It is the idea of the free market as applied to international trade. And government free trade is predominantly advocated by political parties that hold right-wing or liberal economic positions. I guess it's classically liberal economic positions. While economically left-wing political parties generally support protectionism, the opposite of free trade. Most nations today are members of the World Trade Organization, WTO, multilateral trade agreements. Free trade is additionally exemplified by the European Economic Area and the Mercosur, which have established open markets. However, most governments still impose some protectionist policies that are intended to support local employment, such as applying tariffs to imports or subsidies to exports. Governments may also restrict free trade to limit exports of natural resources. Other barriers that may hinder trade include import quotas, taxes, non-tariff barriers such as regulatory legislation. There's a broad consensus among economists that protectionism has a negative effect on economic growth and economic welfare, while free trade and reduction of trade barriers has a positive effect on economic growth. I suppose if GDP measurements are the only value, that's probably generally true, economically speaking. Strictly economically speaking, of course, there are other factors involved. Liberalization of trade can cause significant and unequally distributed losses and the economic dislocation of workers in import competing sectors. Two simple ways to understand the proposed benefits of free trade are through David Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage and by analyzing the impact of tariffs or import quotas. An analysis using the law of supply and demand and economic effects of a tax can be used to show the theoretical benefits and disadvantages of free trade. Though it creates winners and losers, the broad consensus among economists is that free trade is a large and unambiguous net gain for society. Because the doctrine of free trade dates back, I think, to the days of Imperial Spain. However, it was two early British economists, Adam Smith and David Ricardo, who later developed the idea of free trade into its modern and recognizable forms. Economists who advocated free trade believed trade was the reason why certain civilizations prospered economically. Adam Smith, for example, pointed to increased trade as being the reason for the flourishing of not just the Mediterranean cultures, such as Egypt, Greece, and Rome, but also Bengal, East India, and China. The great prosperity of the Netherlands after throwing off Spanish imperial rule and pursuing a policy of free trade made the free trade mercantilist dispute the most important question in economics for centuries. Free trade policies have battled with mercantilists, protectionists, isolationists, communist populists, and other policies over the centuries. Trade in colonial America was regulated by the British mercantile system through the Act of Trade and Navigations. Until the 1760s, few colonists openly advocated for free trade, in part because the regulations were not strictly enforced. Smuggling was rampant. According to historian Oliver Dickerson, a desire for free trade was not one of the causes of the American Revolution. The idea that the basic mercantile practices of the 18th century were wrong, wrote Dickerson, were not part of the thinking of revolutionary leaders. Free trade came to what would become the United States as a result of the American Revolutionary War. After the British Parliament issued the Prohibitory Acts blockading colonial ports, the Continental Congress responded by effectively declaring economic independence, opening American ports to free trade in April 1776. According to historian John W. Tyler, free trade has been forced on Americans, like it or not. In Britain, free trade became a central principle practiced by the repeal of the Corn Laws in 1846. Large-scale agitation was sponsored by the Anti-Corn Law League under the Treaty of Nanking. China opened 5 treaty ports to world trade in 1843. The first 3 trade agreements, the Cobden-Chevalier Treaty, was put into place in 1860 between Britain and France, which led to successive agreements between other countries in Europe. Many classical liberals, especially the 19th and early 20th century Britain, John Stuart Mill, and others in the United States for much of the 20th century, believed that free trade promoted peace. Woodrow Wilson included free trade rhetoric in the 14-point speech of 1918. In the United States, the Democrat Party favored moderate tariffs used for revenue only for, this is in the 1800s, the Democrat Party favored moderate tariffs for revenue, while the Whigs, which would later become the Republicans, favored high protective tariffs to protect favored industries. The fledgling Republican Party, led by Abraham Lincoln, who called himself a Henry Clay tariff Whig, strongly opposed free trade and implemented a 44% tariff during the so-called American Civil War. The United States and Britain, sometimes considered the home of free trade, employed protectionism to varying degrees, however, throughout history. Britain abolished corn laws, which restricted import of grain, in 1846 in response to domestic pressures, and it reduced protectionism for manufacturers in the mid-19th century when its technological advantage was at its height. But tariffs on manufactured products had returned to 23% by 1950. The United States maintained weighted average tariffs on manufactured products for approximately 40-50% up until the 1950s. There was, of course, the free trade doctrine became implemented in international policy right after the Second World War. During the Cold War, the United States had often been a proponent of reduced tariff barriers and free trade. U.S. helped establish the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT, and later the World Trade Organization, WTO, although it had rejected an early version in the 1950s. In Europe, the 6 countries formed the European Coal and Steel Community in 1951, which became the European Economic Community in 1958. 2 core objectives of the EEC were the development of a common market, subsequently renamed the single market, and establishing a customs union between its members, between its member states. After expanding its membership, the EEC became the European Union in 1993. The European Union, now the world's largest single market, has concluded free trade agreements with many countries around the world. Let's see here. There are some counterarguments to free trade. There are some examples in history of countries actually following a industrial or mercantile or protectionist policies that developed strongly. For example, Germany, under Chancellor Otto von Bismarck, embraced mercantilist approaches that had been anticipated for more than 3 decades earlier. This is the influential book was written by Frederick List. It was to remain the openly acknowledged feature of German economic management for generations. Wildly successful, in fact, German economic growth was very strong, to the point by the dawn of the 20th century, Germany became a threat to British economic hegemony, and which arguably led to the world wars of the 20th century. There's also the story of Japan in the 1870s, 1880s, following the Meiji Restoration or reforms, where they industrialized under mercantilist principles. And of course, China in the 1970s, of course, China's, a lot of this, particularly China's development, was part of, some have traced it back to a Rockefeller plan to coincide with the deindustrialization of the United States. So that's sort of the free trade. Now, of course, that's kind of long-winded, but I figured it was necessary to stake out the kind of brief history and arguments in, you know, for or against free trade. A lot of other issues involved in free trade. We're not just talking with a sterile academic or economic argument here, because there are other factors involved in this. I believe, Joe, you have something to say about that.
Well, I have an opinion, which is that discussing free trade is very similar to discussing the sizes and shapes of UFOs. Are they cigar-shaped? Are they disc? You know, do the inhabitants have ant-shaped heads, or do they look like sponges, you know? There is no such thing. I'm sorry. There's no free trade. There's no free markets. There hasn't been for hundreds of years, certainly since Palmerston Zoo took over European and Asia, all of these markets in the 1800s. So to talk about free trade is curious to me as to why people would even bring up such a thing. And I would say in general, it's just because it's part of the way to keep people from being aware they're enslaved. You know, Goethe pointed out that the most profoundly enslaved person is someone who doesn't know he's been enslaved. And that's the condition that we here in the West find ourselves. The secret society has gained control of the financial, political, and media systems. And so they're able to create concepts like free trade to bamboozle us. There isn't a single example I could think of. You know, when we were, when you thought about free, you mentioned free trade as a topic, I was really, I thought, God, this is, it's fascinating to actually study it and look at it and go into the history of it. Because really what you're studying is sophistry. You're studying propaganda. You're studying how they fool people. And so free trade is one of the real highlights of the oligarchic system when you know they want to move certain products without restraint, usually for malevolent purposes, then they advocate free trade. But when they benefit from, you know, closed off industry, then tariffs. So the thing I would hope we can bring light on is how free trade has been used as a propaganda device. And I thought that it might be of interest for people to actually hear the actual beginning of free trade. I mean, free trade has been around, you know, forever. I mean, there's been different disputes. But in terms of the Masonic world, our world, it really does begin with Adam Smith, not so much Ricardo, that bizarre Sephardic Jew who then converted to Christianity. But really Smith, he was the one who was plugged into the British Masonic ruling class. And he charmed Lord Shelburne. This is the story, on a carriage ride with Jeremy Bentham and he, and they from Edinburgh, I think, down to London. And he told him about the ideas of free trade. And this then led to Shelburne, who was running and the owner, or one of the major owners of the East India Trading Company, to promoting Smith to writing the book. And so people have free trade, and you know, it's kind of a horrible book. And if you've read it, Tim, I mean, I wouldn't recommend it. There's not a lot of, you know, really interesting ideas in it, but it's often cited. You know, people will bring up the idea of the wealth of nations who, typically they're just complete idiots. You know, I mean, when I see like guys on television promote this concept, I don't think they're shills. They actually are simply mind controlled. They actually believe that there is some such a thing like free trade, and that if we have it, we're better than if there's a tariff, you know, so we can't let the Japanese or Chinese widgets in. But first of all, the trade can never be free when the central banks are owned by a few families, right? There's no such thing right off the bat. There's no free market. There's no free trade, because if one group is able to get credit at a cheaper price than everybody else, it doesn't really matter what kind of activity is occurring in terms of trade. It's all the money's going to end up in the same people's pockets anyway, right? So the whole thing is preposterous, and it's a distraction. In terms of Smith, whereas most people think about the wealth of nation, I actually think his 1759 book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, is far more important, because that's actually a book I'd recommend people read. I think people should read that book, even though he's just one of the worst writers imaginable. But there he actually outlined the moral framework. And this is what's important, because this is what, you know, is being justified by the wealth of nations. The wealth of nations is given to us today by the talking heads on TV as though this is some kind of legitimate, you know, theory to have an economic system that is, you know, God help us, more creates more prosperity. You know, this is the idea that's given to us. But
Yeah, and like all sophistry, it has a lot of half truths in it, so it's
Oh, for sure. And I mean, there's no question. And I mean, in every one of them, it's a solid half truth. And it's all, unfortunately, under the umbrella of the Federal Reserve banking system. But there are all kinds, and what they have is logic. You know, the sofas have logic. They use logic and they go, look, A is B, B, you know, and then, but the problem is that it isn't truth. It's just a system of rationalizations. And the theory of moral sentiment, Smith kind of, he wasn't really at that point trying to fool anyone about economy. He was just talking about basically, you know, like how humanity functions. And he, you know, you hear the concept often in our world of animal spirits. You know, they're saying that if the market is, you know, stimulated by lower interest rates, then animal spirits will, you know, come to fore, and the market will be, you know, invigorated by investment, you know, because the animal spirit is now, you know, loose. And so this actually comes from this concept in the theory of moral sentiments. And I'll just read, this is kind of funny because this is actually this little paragraph. This is something people should pay attention to because this is actually the moral structure of our economy and of our political system. And so Adam Smith wrote that hunger, thirst, and the passion which unites the two sexes, the love of pleasure and the dread of pain, prompt us to apply those means for their own sake and without any consideration of their tendency to those beneficent ends which the great director of nature intended to produce by them. That's kind of fancy language, you know, like what does it really mean? Well, you got to sort of break it down. Basically, what he's saying there is do what thou wilt is the whole of the law. Ever heard that expression? That's from Crowley, and that's really, you know, kind of the, you know, abiding principle of the oligarchs today. That Crowley gets it directly from here. This is where it comes from. And inside, that's not a complicated path to understand because Smith worked for Lord Shelburne, who was the owner and manager of the East Asia Trading Company. He became the prime minister. This is where the military intelligence comes from. I'm sure you're aware of this, that British Secret Service comes from basically the East Asia Trading Company. Their intelligence network became the SIS. And so when you see Crowley as, you know, as an agent of MI5, whatever it is, it's a very direct shoot from Adam Smith because the economic control that, East Asian Trading Company was creating was basically using the intelligence network, you know, of spying on everybody, you know, to see how they could best benefit themselves. And so when Crowley then, as a British Secret Service person, says, "Do what thou wilt is the whole of the law," he's really just clarifying what Smith wrote. I mean, Smith is saying that, you know, basically, the passion that you are stimulated by should not be restrained by any intellectual or moral structure.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
The passion is the greed, greed is good, that these things are really what you know, stimulate economy and change. And so you should not be restricting them in any way because the great director of nature intended them to produce, you know, the effects of the passion. So this, of course, is, you know, a little different than the moral structure of Western civilization, but it's what Smith is saying. He's
It's
saying
also proto-Masonic.
100%. I
Yeah.
mean, this literally is nature. See, I was gonna. I saved this little line because before paraphrase I did, he has another sentence, which is my favorite. He wrote, "Nature has directed us to the greater part by these original and immediate instincts." So you see, you really want to get your mind and your soul out of the way. So if you're going to function in the Masonic world. Now, it's been pointed out that this is a justification for 100% nihilism, because if you have this as your perspective, which, of course, you know, Shelburne and Smith and the whole Masonic clump of the British aristocracy and ruling class do, then you can pretty well slaughter anybody gets in your way, right? No problem. I mean, think about Smith's statement in light of the opium wars, mm-hmm. right? It's very logical. And Palmerston goes and slaughters everybody because he's just being corrected by his instinct to make money. There's no need for a lot of fancy justification or anything like this. You know, this is what's moving me forward. And when you think of Palmerston's, destruction of his Irish tenants and his contribution to the Irish Holocaust, you know, the Irish were just bad people and he wanted to kill them. So there it goes, right?
And you could get more for the food in international markets getting good in the Irish market. So you could export it, yeah.
Of course you can. So it all just makes perfect sense. You have money is there, but you also get rid of people you don't like. You are, do what thou willst is the whole of the law. It's kind of, the fact that you get more power justifies your behavior in and of itself. Doesn't really matter what Smith is saying that is if you bring up the idea of like, well, there was something about the humanity of the Irish that we wanted to protect, or the humanity of the Chinese that we slaughtered because they wouldn't agree to opium addiction. If you bring this up, you're just being stupid, right? I mean, that just doesn't fit into nature has directed us to the greater part of these by original and immediate instincts. I mean, he's talking about immediate basic instincts. Right. That's exactly what it is. And that's why I really think that even though it didn't get a lot of press, The Theory of Moral Sentiments is really an important book for people to understand, because it's more of a, it's more of an explanation as to how we got to where we are today.
Well, it's because it's interesting because Adam Smith appears to be basing his views on sort of the Newtonian cosmology, which became sort of the Whig view of how the world works, how reality functions. The idea that you don't have right or wrong or morality. The universe is governed by sort of a mechanical operation. It's inertia, it's gravity, and there's no real thought you have to put into this stuff. It's all natural. And of course, Newtonian cosmology is developed to rationalize the plunder of the British the English Reformation. Much of the, of course, Adam Smith is part of what we call the Scottish Enlightenment, Edinburgh, that area. And it's this intellectual flourishing that we're taught. But the Scottish Enlightenment was pretty much was funded by the British East India Company and the British oligarchs, who I believe sort of adopted Adam Smith. He was, his father died when he was a young boy. He was a fatherless man. So this is sort of this is a pattern we see when they take fatherless people and then who are more vulnerable, and they're mold them in their shape. And Adam Smith was funded by these, like Shelburne and these British oligarchs at the time to promote this view of the world, just rationalized, their economic system they were imposing.
Right. So Smith, people wonder, well, is Smith a Freemason, mm-hmm. And in fact, they can't prove it, but I'll show you that he was. Smith amazingly had all of his documents burned upon his death. This is very unusual. Didn't happen a lot in this era. And I think why they did it, because they didn't want Smith's connection into Masonry. And also they were already probably realizing that free trade was a useful propaganda tool, and they didn't want Smith's direct connection into Shelburne and the East Asia Trading Company and that whole moral cesspool to be exposed. And so it was burned. So people say, well, we don't really know if he was, but there is a way to actually verify this. In fact, Smith was a member of what's called the Oyster Club. Now, this was hard. It's one of these strange gentlemen clubs, you know, kind of quasi-mystical. They had like 15 guys in it. 100% of them are Masons, so it was a Mason organization. It, of course, it met in Edinburgh, close to the Grand Lodge, right across the street. And Smith was a member, so it would have been just out of pattern for him not to have been a Mason. This, of course, would be perhaps part of the justification for the burning of his records. But I wanted to point out something, that the Oyster Club is very important because it was the club that created and promoted Robert Burns, the Spanish bard. I mean, excuse me, the Scottish bard. Okay, now I wanted to just contrast something. I think this is very useful. You know, Burns was a huge Mason, and so he gave a poem. He wrote a poem called Masonic Song, and it's about Masonry. And you know, a very short little poem, and I'm just going to read the last phrase of it because I wanted to contrast this. He goes, "So ye powers who preside o'er the wind and the tide, who marked each element's border, who formed this frame with benefit aim, whose sovereign statute in order, within this dear mansion may wayward contention or withered envy never enter." Now here's the key lines. He goes, "May secrecy round be the mystical bound, and brotherly love be the center." He's talking about a Masonic lodge. So may secrecy round be the mystical bound, and brotherly love be the center. And Burns is literally created by Adam Smith and the Oyster Club, right? All these Masons, they're the ones who actually, you know, gave him the money, funding. They gave it access to the periodicals he first published in. He was created by them to the extent, you know, that he becomes a public figure. Now, Tim, okay, here's my question. Now, brotherly love be the center. Wasn't that different than Adam Smith's statement about trade between human beings? What happened to brotherly love when it comes? See what I'm saying? Is that there is so Smith is not a psychopath. He creates a psychopathic philosophy, but that's just silly. He's just using that as a tool to confuse people. This is really what's at the heart of all this, is that there is brotherly love. However, secrecy round be the mystical bound. See, so we don't get to see in, but inside you've got all of this brotherly love. Out here, outside the lodge, here where we're getting the results of free trade and of the central banking system, there's no such thing. See, it's a really tough, rough world, and psychopaths are people espousing psychopathic philosophies seem to have power. But man, it's different there. So the question is, of course, is that why? What is it, what exactly is the basis for the brotherly love? I mean, and you can ask this question in another way. It's with Palmerston. Palmerston slaughtered the Chinese, he slaughtered the Irish, but in 1842 he said, you know, now is the time for the Jews to return to their homeland. All right? I mean, remember, this is the whole, all of the effort to create Israel comes from the British Masonic ruling class. The rabbis who are often, you know, given as like the creator of Zionism, that's completely ludicrous. They didn't have the political power to create a Delhi. All of the power to set up Israel is coming from this, you know, they're the ones who are creating the ownership of the Suez Canal, bringing in the gunships, maneuvering the Ottoman Empire out of existence. They're doing all of the surveys. I mean, it's just this enormous effort from Palmerston forward. So it's the same question as, well, why is Palmerston, an Anglican, so have so much brotherly love for the Jews and nothing for the Chinese and the Irish, and why does Smith espouses a philosophy of economy that is literally psychopathic. I mean, this is 100% just no empathy at all. You'd have to be an extreme psychopath to actually carry out, you know, his trade concept is as interaction between humans. But then all this brotherly love inside the Masonic Lodge. I'm baffled, Tim. What's up with all that?
Well, I guess this is an attempt to control the narrative and also the intellectual environment, which is then used to rationalize, you know, the desires and appetites of these men, you know, within the lodge. Prior, you know, it was a time when economics was thought of as a sort of a subset of morality, and Adam Smith and his generation kind of turned it on its head, and economics, morality became a subset of economics. So everything was rationalized if the market dictated, you know, supply, demand, these things. You know, if there's cheap labor somewhere, why not exploit it? Of course, a lot of these arguments go because at some point they arbitrarily imposed the doctrine of free trade or property rights after decades and decades of dispossession and genocide. So it's opportunistically imposing this doctrine after you're in control. It's like imposing the gold standard when you own all the gold, you know.
Yeah.
So it's these are, again, like I said, these arguments are it's effective sophistry because it is based on half truths. So we look at something like free trade, and we understand that the concept of more hands make for lighter work. It expands the knowledge of an economy, of information, and it invites foreign investment into these things. And there is some element, or at least there is some degree where that is indeed true. Like anything with the economics, international trade, or anything in life, we have to take sort of an Aristotelian approach and find the golden mean. What is the optimal level of these things? Obviously, if you're in an isolated economy, you can preserve your unique culture, but you do it usually at the cost of extreme poverty and ignorance. So some openness and some of these things is necessary, depending on what type of country you are, how big you are in these things. Like anything, a concept can be weaponized. Freedom is often weaponized, and it has been weaponized, whether it's free thought, free speech, free trade, free love, these things. The moment you start exercising free thought or free speech to undermine the plans of the oligarchs, that's when free speech becomes regulated and you're deplatformed. That's when, obviously they'll talk about, you know, the free movement of labor and immigration and these things and using surplus labor in a given area. This is the market working, but we don't. Of course, we don't have access to Rockefeller's, you know, Tarrytown mansion. We can't walk into George Soros's mansions when we want. So obviously, they believe in, you know, borders and property rights and these things when it suits them. But understanding how free trade is weaponized, you have to understand the history, how coercion and war has been used to pry markets open, to undermine weakened cultures so that you can be exploited under the cover of free trade. Of course, that's the history of the Opium Wars. It's the history of much of United States' relationship with Latin America and much of the Third World, because we're speaking of corporations and banking interests that use the cover of the state to achieve their objectives in these countries, in these areas, which are sort of looked upon as, you know, underdeveloped, resource-rich in terms of labor and also natural resources to be exploited, and also to prevent any other alternative methods of development. A good example is when the Jesuits were in the 17th century, were doing their missionary work in South America, in Paraguay. They were teaching rudimentary industrial manufacturing methods, and also along with language and religion, to the Guaranis, and that program was systematically shut down by Freemasons within both the Spanish and Portuguese, and also the Catholic Church. So this is a complicated subject, because these institutions, the countries, are infiltrated by Freemasonry and these things. But that was shut down to allow for the continuation of slavery and the continued exploitation, sort of a proto-Washington consensus, sort of the economic hitman model, which has been the norm for centuries. And this also clouds the issue, because then out of this rises Marxism and socialism and communism as a reaction to free market or laissez-faire dogma, which, of course, it really isn't laissez-faire. That's an opportunistic argument, again, which is then sort of inserted at an opportune time,
Tim, I want to give an example of free trade, because I actually, 2 years ago, went on what could be called a free trade junket. I went to San Miguel de Allende. It's in Mexico. It's central Mexico. And it's where they have the corridor of the industries that have left the United States and are doing their manufacturing now in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it is this enormous, it's a corridor, kind of like a rectangle, goes way, just starts at one end and just goes out into the desert for 20 miles. And so it's where they make cars, they assemble stuff, and they've got all these plants up. And I met with people there who were saying that, they're saying that it is so polluting that they're literally worried that the farms within like 100 miles of the place are all going to start seizing up because there's so much toxicity. So you can see that there was free trade, right? Mm-hmm. They were there, but they also, they didn't have any more environmental restraints. They could get the cost of making the Chevy Bolt down to the lowest possible number, but don't worry about polluting or putting stuff into the groundwater because, hey, it's Mexico. Now, I got to tell you the funny story. So I was there, and I was sitting in a restaurant in San Miguel kind of musing about all of this toxicity, and I was talking to this American business guy who was down there, and he was selling widgets, And I said, this doesn't look to me like it's working out too well for the Mexicans. And he goes, well, I said, it's trade. It goes back and forth. And I said, well, they're moving the cars up there. What's coming down here? And he goes, oh, well, they're benefiting quite a bit. He goes, Monsanto is now able to like bring in all of the glyphosate you can imagine without any restraint. He goes, all the GMO. He says, no, they've got this, huge, just pipeline now. They're just bringing on, they're really helping the Mexican farmer. That might be, I actually spent some time looking at the farming techniques and stuff, which are all, this is actually quite related to the concept of free trade, unfortunately. But, you have to step back from the idea of free trade and just think of it as, well, it's a system of slavery. Free trade is just a bamboozle. It's with the idea of a workers' paradise that's going to come. The Mexicans are getting higher salaries. They're making widgets. They don't have to immigrate into the United States to make a living. But they have the industries that control them and control the product have no environmental restraints. In the long run, this probably isn't going to work out too well. But don't worry, because if your food sources dry up, you'll be able to use the GMO seeds with glyphosate and eat all the burritos you want. So, I met down there with a group that is interested in kind of preserving Mexican groundwater. And they're a little upset about the whole thing. And they would be in opposition to free trade. They would be in opposition to what Adam Smith would call instinct. And this is why the idea of a single force, right, being a principle of economics is always incoherent. There must be restraint. But once there's restraint, there's dialogue. And dialogue always will bring about the idea of, well, there's two people, 10 people, 100 people, and suddenly you have the idea of there's democratic forces like that are in play. It isn't just oligarchs. It isn't just one Masonic lodge controlling the entire economic universe. So, that was my little run down to Mexico. I didn't see free trade as too beneficial for them.
Yeah, that's I think economists would call the pollution down there an externality. imposing the externalities on the people, the aquifers or the people of central Mexico. Of course, a lot of people have written about the effects of NAFTA on Mexican agriculture and how the, of course, the opening up of Mexican markets to subsidized American corn undermined Mexican agriculture and therefore culture and living patterns. And this created the Great Migration North since the 1990s, which has had a significant impact on the U.S. economy and culture. And this is the way how peoples can be people can be manipulated through trade agreements, currency manipulation. Of course, this also coincides with the peso crisis, which was a currency manipulation issue again. You can't have free trade when you have currency manipulation, really, because you have people who can short certain currencies, especially when you have a dollarized economy. Those who control the creation of dollars can control the global economy, and those sort of create long-term, widespread cultural changes that aren't really talked about in the terms of policy. This isn't like our politicians talk about the stuff and campaign on them. These policies aren't debated, but nevertheless, the macroeconomic policies are instituted, which create these things anyway. An example of that would be the 1970s and the collapse of the Bretton Woods Agreement, a previous example of currency manipulation and imperial policy through the imposition of the dollar standard in the wake of the Second World War. But in the 1970s, it was decided that the United States would close the gold window, cut off what remained of the gold standard, and impose the petrodollar. And that was created by various means of fomenting of a war in the Middle East, a deal with the Arabs. This also coincided with a plan hatched, or at least articulated by Henry Kissinger in 1974, to sort of curb the population growth of the Third World through impoverishment, immiserating them further, or retarding their development through debt. And that was, of course, the energy crisis played a big part in that, the fomented energy crisis, the false shortages of the 1970s. This also had an important impact on the U.S. economy and culture at the time. The 1970s sort of the end of the post-war optimism, economic dislocation. This coincided with the sexual revolution and the fundamentally changing of the idea of the family, the idea of the male wage earner providing for the family and the homemaker and these things. This changed, of course, because feminism was being promoted at the time. A large part of promoting feminism wasn't just widespread propaganda in the media, promotion of Ms. Magazine, fashion, whatever, figures like Gloria Steinem. It's also creating the economic conditions which make the old model appear no longer viable. And so now you have the phenomenon of the two wage earner. And we touched on this last week when we talked about white nationalism, is this created different economic behavior and patterns. One thing is, once you have two earners, you have a lot more disposable income, and your spending habits change. This distorts the economy morally. And so now you have consumer-based driven economy, as opposed to what you have with the family, which is perhaps more based on savings and planning for the future. It's a short-term economy. And this, again, a sort of the failure of the system they're imposing is actually its success, because of the culture changes it brings about. So now we have a conditions today where people no longer even assume in their 20s that they are going to get married. Women are going to have babies and take care of their children. The husband's going to work and provide for the family. Now everyone must go out in the workforce, be a wage slave, and perhaps have a child or two later on. And this creates the sort of the depopulation of the West, coincides with the deindustrialization of the West, because the imposition of the petrodollar at a time of rampant inflation, this what it effectively did was overvalue the dollar in international markets, which makes manufacturing in the United States artificially more expensive relative to foreign markets. So now it becomes cheaper to manufacture many of these things abroad, like in China. And this going China's industrialization coincided with what was occurring in the United States. So now you have this deindustrialization occurring, the loss of manufacturer jobs, the loss of blue collar, high paying jobs for a lot of men. At the same time, it's subsidizing imports and creating industrialization abroad, which appears to be part of the Trilateralist plan that was, Trilaterals Commission that was formed in 1973. Under the leadership of Brzezinski, who was pulled from, I think, Colombia by Nelson Rockefeller. So again, when you're talking about free trade, you're talking about culture, you're talking about economics, you're talking about sexual issues, you're talking about morality. It simply isn't as simple as comparative advantage. I trade with you, and we're both better for, we both decide that we're engaging in a mutually beneficial trade. It is global manipulation going on with these free trade agreements. And of course, modern free trade agreements are better described as managed trade. And along with these free trade agreements come with transnational or organizations which transcend sovereignty, undermine what remains of self-government, because now a lot of these decisions are being handed over to international organizations that are empowered through these trade agreements to more or less undermine rule of law in said countries, because now international bodies made up of appointed trade representatives would decide policies, environmental policies, tax policies, monetary policies, and these things. And the best illustration of this is what's occurred in the EU since the European Union was formed, so.
Yeah, Tim, I was just thinking, that was really well said. Very, very clear.
I don't even know what I just said, so.
Well, this is what I was thinking when this is how good it was. I was thinking, we should encapsulate that and play it at the beginning of every like Bloomberg economic show on TV. That should be the first 3-minute intro, so that people then could see that, well, the people who are coming next are just completely lying. They're just because here's the point. If say you got this like guy, he's like this is 1985, 1980. He's a white male, and you go, well, we're gonna like get rid of the housewife taking care of the children. We're gonna put her in the workplace, and we're gonna get rid of your job because that's gonna get shipped overseas. And then we're going to basically get rid of like all of the ethnic connections and stuff that you have because we're just going to move you into this gigantic planned housing complex. And then if the white guy goes, well, I don't really want to do that, the answer would be what? You're opposed to free trade? You see? I mean, that's just how when you get it in the right context, when you explain it right, as you did. People can see that you can see that it's the sophistry, it's the BS that this isn't sincere. This is not sincere economic philosophy. Adam Smith is not talking about his personal worldview. He's trying to manipulate people. The real worldview is Robert Burns and the Masonic song. That's where the secrecy around a little collective group. Brotherly love in there, and then outside of that, the basically just genocidal psychopathism to just kill anybody who gets in your way, and that's really what we're dealing with. That's how bad it is that people will sit there and listen to these absurd economic arguments about free trade versus social. I mean, whatever the particular debate is, well, NAFTA. And they don't get that really this is all just bamboozlement. There's just nothing there that's real. What's real is power. What's real is genocide. And these are just the if you just looked at all of these things that are coming forward economically, of figuring out, well, how does this destroy culture? How does this basically destroy economic wealth? How does this destroy family? And then ask the question, well, who's going to benefit? I think if you just go through that process and not just sit there kind of staring at the TV, listening to, Sean Hannity talk about the values of free trade, you're going to be a lot better off. You have a lot clearer understanding of the world. Analyze all of this stuff from that perspective because it'll all lead right back to the little brotherhood, right? To the group that Robert Burns talks about, and brotherly love at the center. May secrecy round be the mystical bound and brotherly love be the center. Folks, we're not inside the center. This is the problem. If you're not inside, you don't. You're what Adam Smith talks about, where just let loose, the instincts. Just get whatever you want. Just do whatever you want. Be whatever you want. Doesn't matter. So that's the real problem with free trade, is that it doesn't exist. It's just being used to fool people. And you need to basically very carefully go through the system that Tim outlined in his well stated speech, where he was talking about the you have to look at the cultural elements. The free trade is just a component. You can't just break out, money from everything else that's going on. Money is just a small part of the whole thing.
Yeah, and of course, with money, you motivate people, and you control the flow of money and capital. You can wage a cultural war, sub rosa, which they've done, and you see it with the foundations. And I think I had that quote from Michael Jones's book on John Gardner Kroll about how the foundations constituted what we call a secret government, how they would wage sort of a culture revolution just below the surface by means of funding and their influence in society. And it came a, this program came across as sort of heterodox, but it wasn't. It was actually being controlled by the Senate, which is very Masonic, because they had their agents within academia, within media, and then the government would then pick up on these ideas that are being promoted by the foundation, which is usually had something to do with subversion of some sort of sexual morality, which is interesting. Then it'd be picked up by the government, and the government would be implemented in the policy. And then all of a sudden, before you know it, culture has changed. And then you're, if you're the odd man out, sticking to wholesome values, what was considered wholesome and responsible values a generation before it, now you're on the outside looking in. You're the, you're the heretic, that has to be purged. And we see that today around us with the, sort of this inversion of values, which may get us back to Crowley.
It does. It
So,
absolutely does get us back. I mean, he's like the real free trade agent. Another, I think, interesting quote was Shelburne's when he was prime minister, and this was after the American Revolutionary War, and they decided that, we're going to let this group be its own nation, but we have to have some control. And so this was, you got into this whole thing about free trade, that this was where it really first becomes, kind of a mainstream media, was the battle between Britain and the United States as to whether or not there would be, would we permit free trade or not. And Shelburne gave a speech, and he said, we should reject monopoly. Now he's calling, tariffs and all this stuff monopoly, using that expression, monopoly. But he's just talking about trade. It is the English, situated as we are between the old world and the new, between Southern and Northern Europe, all we ought to covet on earth is free trade. With more industry, with more capital, with more enterprise than any trading nation on earth, it ought to be our constant cry, let every market be open. Right. Now you can see from that statement, he's not talking about benefiting the trading partner, is it? He's talking about, we will have more, we will win the trading relationships, right? Clear as a bell. He is under the perspective of his protege, or the person that he was, getting to write the material, Adam Smith. And this is just another way of expressing it, is that we want every market to be open, just like Palmerston opened up the opium market in Canton. Because we're going to win. We have more capital, and we have more control over our industries and more weird get widgets and stuff. So every market must be open. And so this is, you can see the history of free trade is really, really ugly.
Also, what happens if you believe, if you're an advocate or a devotee of the doctrine of free trade, and that you can just access foreign markets, whether it's labor or resources, and base your economic growth model on that, and everything's going to be fine. The problem with that is that you become dependent on foreign markets, whether it's trade routes, sea routes, land routes, and these things, that all of a sudden you are very vulnerable to the vicissitudes of geopolitical intrigues. An example of that is the fate of Germany. In the 19th century, in the middle of the 19th century, around the 1840s, 1850s, which you had a lot of turmoil in Central Europe, and a lot of this was brought about because in the wake of the defeat of Napoleon, British started penetrating German markets or inundating German markets with their cheap manufacturers, largely which were financed through this, exploited or cheap labor, like the Opium Wars or slave labor and these things into the German markets, using Jewish peddlers to market the stuff in Germany. And this created a lot of economic dislocation because local, businesses couldn't compete with the cheap goods being brought in via the British Empire into the German markets. And this led to the unification of Germany and the creating of the German common market under Bismarck that I earlier referred to, and led to the development of German economy, a development that was so successful that Britain had to find a pretext to go to war with Germany in the early 20th century. With this industrialization that was occurring, by 1900, and this is all this is, I mean, this is in the documents. This largely led to the First World War. I think it might have been Balfour who was presented with the reality of German economic competition, and he said, "We can either compete with them by working harder or go to war, and I think we'll just go to war with them and knock them down a peg." And that's what it did. That's what they decided to do. But then Germany sort of, remember, Germany starts to population expands, and of course during the First World War there were Germany realized that it was very vulnerable for to a to being embargoed, its population, so the British embargoed Germany even after the war up until June 1919, and so they realized that a certain amount of autarky was necessary in order for independence. And this, of course, informs much of the doctrine or the ideas behind the National Socialism and Hitler, and the need for for living space was largely breaking free from the threat of embargo. But remember, the Lebensraum and the Nazis' doctrine of continental expansion was a reaction, largely a reaction to the British Leviathan, and it's a doctrine, Mackinder doctrine, which sought to isolate Germany and Russia to maintain its dominance. And you have an example of, as long as free trade favored Britain, it followed it. But as soon as free trade didn't favor Britain, it resorted to embargo. So it is it's empty rhetoric.
Yeah, exactly. It's just they are free traders when it's, benefits the oligarchs, and they are opposed to it when it doesn't. It's simple as that. It's always just, I mean, I don't think there's been a sincere kind of free trade proposal in 200 years.
Well, another example is, remember, we've had a lot of rhetoric the past 20 years about China manipulating its currency to support its export market. Basically, they devalue the yuan to order to create large markets for their manufactured goods abroad, which fill the shelves of Walmart. And it makes for good rhetoric when politicians are representing the interest of U.S. manufacturers, unfortunately, which it seems to be a dwindling bunch. But the reality is that Chinese currency manipulation is in concert with the trilateralist plan that was hatched in the 1970s because they buy U.S. debt. And of course, much of U.S., America's trade deficit is financed by debt, which is purchasing U.S. bonds, which is all goes back to the whole petrodollar system. That's what we did, set up with the Arabs, is, all the oil you sell, as long as you buy U.S. Treasury bonds, put it in U.S. banks, or buy weaponry. U.S. weaponry that we sell to you, which you can't use because you don't have the training to do it, but we'll sell it to you anyway. So that currency manipulation is a whole part of the sort of this Chai America plan that we have, that we still see today. And I don't know to what extent just rhetoric or not, because to the extent that China's manipulating its currency, it's doing it so it could buy U.S. treasuries and also input their goods in the United States. And this is done at the expense of the Chinese consumer, because the Chinese consumer isn't consuming much. And this is what you see in a lot of countries, is you don't have a consumer economy because they're busy working and saving, but they're forced into that by the financial pol the macro, the monetary policies of their governments. The Chinese Central Bank, which for all its, supposed independence, is probably working fully within sort of the Rockefeller condominium that we see,
Of course, it's actually sort of amusing if it wasn't so tragic that. You talk about debt, right? Well, so you have this situation where you have free trade. The Chinese, they have cheaper manufacturing, there's free trade, they can bring in their widgets. We finance the trade deficit with debt, right? Okay, fine. But then there's interest on the debt. Right.
Yes.
And see, this is then you have this is where the public kind of loses their train of thought. They don't see exactly what's going on, because all of that debt is benefiting a group, 100% of it. All of the, I mean, who buys the US debt, right? Well, it's the banking families. They buy it. How do they buy it? Well, they buy it. They just create money out of thin air, give it to the government. Now, here's where the magic occurs. They get the government to pay them 3%, but they charge themselves only 1% for the debt that they created.
Yeah.
So, gee, this debt thing is wonderful, right? I mean, you just can't lose here with the debt. And so this system will bleed the value out of a currency over a long period, just as it is now with the dollar. But you can see that the nature of debt as it's set up is done so just to benefit the owners of the central banking system. If we wanted to just create debt under an efficient system that would be to the least damage to the public, all the government would have to do would have itself be the creator of the debt, right? It doesn't need the central bank. It has the ability to make money out of thin air just as well as the Fed does. And now you would have no interest on the debt, right? But you see, that wouldn't work, because who would benefit from that?
Yeah, you wouldn't get the concentration of wealth in
Yeah,
there.
and so that's why the when you see these massive debt numbers, the trade deficit, the federal, and you wonder, well, gee, should we get that under control? Well, the problem is it's too beneficial, to the wrong groups.
Yeah, it's just like when you're talking about the national debt right now. There's a budget, quote, government shutdown because of a dispute over the wall funding, supposedly, and there's debt in these things. And when the government borrows $500 billion, $1 trillion in debt a year, finance a third of its budget, who's benefiting from that? It's, again, like you said, it's the people, the handful of families which control the Federal Reserve banks that own them, and also ultimately own the Bank of International Settlements. And so these, again, through these central banks, the debt is used to bleed the wealth from the nations, and also to concentrate wealth in a very few hands, which we see today when you talk about the concentration of wealth, the wealth of these few banking families. You have, and also you see a sort of a the corporatization of the economy itself, a centralization of the economy. It's very gradual. You may notice that you don't see very many independent hardware stores or stationery stores or bakeries anymore, because it's being corporatized. A function of that is through debt, the weaponization of finance, largely brought about through usury, also the international drug trade, which is another, it takes us back to the opium wars,
Yeah.
is the money that is raised through the trade of illegal narcotics, which is not. The drug trade isn't suppressed, or there's no drug war. The war is there to manage it, so the right cartels are functioning at any given time for the benefit of Chase Manhattan Bank, the finance, because that's where the money ultimately gets deposited. But that money is capital, which feeds Wall Street, which will finance operations. I don't know. I've read some articles claiming that Walmart's stupendous growth was fed by the money laundering, largely drug money and these things. Same thing with Staples through Bain Capital. And so this gets into sort of the black economy, the underground economy, which is much larger than people realize, and also has played a fundamental role in the distorting not only the U.S. economy and also of society itself, because the drug trade itself results the slowly, talk about introducing toxins into an environment. Well, you can see the introduction of whether it's meth or cocaine or crack or heroin and these things. And we've done other shows how various wars, like the Vietnam War, were used, the Cold War, were used to create arenas where these drugs could be produced, at least the raw materials could be produced, then refined, shipped in. This, in return, arms were sent. So this is sort of a circulatory system going on there, much in the same way that the slave trade in the 18th and early 19th century, we had, the rum, the guns, the sugar, and the Atlantic slave trade, and it had its own logic. And we see the same thing with the illegal drug trade today. And you can arguably say, in a way, that the same way that NAFTA is to free trade to what the drug trade is to the free trade in drugs, it's managed in way. And so we have full access to drugs, but those drugs that we finance when we use them, it also pays for the deindustrialization and the distortion of the US economy, which leads to the despair and hopelessness, which ultimately feeds the demand for more drugs. It really is
Well,
satanic.
we don't want to slow down the flow of Oxycontin from China into the US because that would restrain some free trade.
Exactly.
And the Chinese aren't really going to listen too much to an argument of the idea, well, it's destroying us, culturally, because after the opening wars, they're probably not in a mood to listen to that argument.
It's karma.
Yeah, no, that's right. But the problem, of course, is that they don't, they see the white person in a general sense. They don't understand the Masonic brotherly love circle, this small group that is also influencing their own political reality, So it's a difficult thing. I was going to, you brought up Bain Capital, and that's a good example because, with Bain Capital and Walmart, they're all good examples, but the large corporations, Romney would act, who was one of the owners of Bain Capital, he would make the argument that he creates jobs. Remember, he was running for president, he goes, "I create jobs." And he says it's part of the creative destruction of free trade. I can remember him actually saying this in one of the debates, and advocating free trade. Because Staples brings in nothing but the Chinese crap and sells it, right? And so he said, and he's creating jobs because he's got all these guys on minimum wage, at the big box Staples stores, right?
Yeah, and then they're on EBT cards and food stamps to subsidize their
Sure,
wages.
immediately, because you're not paying, the taxpayer has to pick up their food and
The
stuff
difference,
because
yeah.
But anyway, the whole thing is just so insane. But so Romney, he actually would talk about, well, some jobs are lost, but other jobs are gained. Like there's some kind of, this is just a normal process of the free trade creative destruction.
Yeah, this is more sophistry and half-truths.
Oh yeah, but the fact is the jobs that are being created are all minimum wage. Jobs that are all lost are owners of small businesses who made products for stationery stores and people who own stationery stores, right? This is so you have to, when you hear, the propaganda, it's very useful to step back and just go through the process that Tim outlined, where you look at the cultural destruction that the economic policy would have, and then ask the question, who's going to benefit from that? And then you, I think, will have a clearer, understanding of the world and a clearer path to resistance,
Well,
Because
I'm sorry, go ahead.
no, I was just going to say, because if people would point out stuff like Walmart and Amazon, that these aren't real companies, that these are just ways in which the oligarch is taking over the means of production and the distribution of everything.
Well, yeah, this is why we don't get a clear look at the books and whether
Yeah.
these companies are actually profitable or actually they're actually competing. People look at these things as, and there's again, there's some obviously there's benefit to industrialization and economies of scale. And again, it goes back to the golden mean thing. What's the optimal level of industrialization? Because if industrialization comes at the cost of environmental destruction, which often it did, then you're just simply laying the cost off on future generations or somebody else, the person downstream, that sort of thing. But I mean, if you're like a corporation like Tyson's Food or Walmart or even Amazon that's being either subsidized heavily by the taxpayer or is, getting access to cheap capital via, cheaper interest rates or even, laundered money, your growth rate is going to be much more, far more, it's going to be stupendous compared to your competitor. Then you get
you
the concentration.
You can't compete against Amazon or Microsoft because it's because they are basically structures of the oligarch's establishment of a technological slave state. And when people complain about them, they say, well, are you against free trade?
Yeah. And they're not subject to the constraints of money because they create the money.
Exactly.
Whereas we have to balance our checkbook. We can't add, when I pay bills, if I'm come up short, I can't simply add a zero to my checking account to cover the, to cover it. Why can't that be, if I could just simply add zeros and say, well, I'm just adding animal spirits to the economy when I do that.
Yeah, right. And this is
stimulating economic activity.
And if you ask, well, what is your moral justification? You just say, well, like Adam Smith said, this is just how the instincts move me. My instinct was to not pay my debts, and my instinct was to make a lot of money. And so nature has directed me to the greater part by my original and immediate instincts, right? So there you are. Now, the problem is some people are able to have the power to express their immediate instincts, but the rest of us, well, we don't, you see. And this is the basic line of sophistry that everyone should recognize when they hear this, the BS about free trade, is that, if you are under the restraints of a controlled economic system that is to your detriment, then this idea about opening up, other countries and all this stuff under the auspice of free trade, I just have to realize it's just another way to bamboozle you, That's all it is.
Yeah,
just,
and the is obvious about free trade is the pretext. The free trade is a pretext to establishing a new world order, and that's been admitted by Brzezinski and Kissinger. I mean, look at all these free trade agreements, whether it's the European Union. Of course, this grew out of the coal and steel community of the 1950s and the economic community of the 1960s and 70s, and these things ultimately to undermine sovereignty. And sovereignty is one of these things where, yeah, you can always pathologize sovereignty the same way you pathologize family or the father figure. Bring out the worst example to say to undermine the idea. But what sovereignty is and what borders are, it's a way of controlling a given area to so you have a homeland or a political establishment or political situation which represents your interest. And
sovereignty is just
reflects your culture.
It's just a control over oligarchs.
Yeah,
that's all it is. That's all. If you really think about what is sovereignty,
it's like morality.
It is just the starting point to control oligarchs from forcing you into automatic weapon fire or to have some control over the culture that you live in. The EU was sold to Europeans as a way of getting rid of the inefficiency of too many currencies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of the restraints of borders for trade. I remember, people forget about this, but I was there. I can remember all that. And they argued the benefits of freedom. They talked about how America, the states have all benefited because there's free trade between Minnesota and New York, right? And therefore we had this more powerful economic engine that everyone was benefiting by, right? Now, this was how it was sold. Now, you're sitting there in Sweden looking at, a million Nigerians, in your downtown area who are there to take benefit of the welfare system you have, and you have no capacity to restrain them, right? You can't keep them out of your country. Because the group that designates immigration policies is not any longer anyone you could even talk to.
Yeah, it's the European Commission or something. Yeah.
Yeah, and these are appointed positions. They're not even so this was again. It was just the public bought a bill of goods control was, you know, more and more ossified in a smaller and smaller group. And now when you have things like the immigration policy where North Africans and Turks and a lot of people from different cultures who are not really easy to assimilate into European cultures are brought in, the Europeans just sitting there on the outside looking in. They're literally on the outside of the EU Planning Commission's looking in. Okay? What they gave up was sovereignty. So there's an example where sovereignty's major function was just to restrain oligarchs.
Yeah, and if you do have sort of a, what do you call a patriotic economy that has some, that's, you know, generally autarkic or independent from the global economic system, you're not subject to the vicissitudes of the global economic, you know, system, which is controlled by malevolent Freemasonic, Judeo-Masonic psychopaths.
Exactly.
You know, and so, and that, even if you're even discounting, let's say, malevolent intentions, these people still are, they're subject to animal spirits and the madness of crowds, and they can make mistakes and miscalculate. Then you're subject, if your currency is dollarized, then you're subject to the whims of their decisions. And we saw that happen in Asia and in Mexico. And really, the reality is, if you really study it, these panics are scientific. They're brought about.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's from 29 or something, or in Mexico in the 90s or in the 70s, these things, because that's an example to goose the market and then short it. And again, with central banks and economic policies, these things can be created. Also with militaries and intelligence agencies, areas can be destabilized and be targeted for an area to foment a crisis like the Middle East in the 1970s or Central America in the 1970s and 80s, or what's going on in North Africa a few years ago with Libya. To foment the EU crisis, and a lot of that why that's being brought about, you know, none of it is being brought out for the stated reasons, and, you know, so we all know there's some sort of injury going on there, and it is malevolent, you know.
Of course, if I was running for president, and I am considering it, but I'm just kidding. My you know, the adage I would be saying over and over again is, I am not only opposed to free trade, I am an advocate of no trade, zero trade, because what we really want is a country inside of which everything that you really need is being produced here, and that and all of the controls over the system, the flow of stuff, is decisions you make. You don't really need any flat screen TVs from Korea. You figure a way out to do it here. You don't really want to do that. Then really, I would actually advocate no trade.
Well, this goes to the question. This is a morality issue. Again, we are subordinating economics to morality, which, you know, again, perhaps is a better way to look at it. Because I was reading an article on Hungary, Orbán's Hungary. And how they've tried to create sort of they're fighting back at this globalist trend, and then the globalists argue that the Orbán government's corrupt. Well, yeah, but what's your definition of corruption and compared to what? But good example is that he's been able to reduce the national debt, cut it in half. It's maintained stable economic growth. At the same time, this comes because a lot of Hungarians are simply not consuming as much; they're saving more. You know,
yeah.
But who's, yep, like, I would say, when you talk about no trade or, you know, no international trade, well, Joe, that would have a significant impact on the GDP. You know,
yeah, I know the GDP. That's a number that's really significant. If oligarch A brings in 200 tons of opium. And oligarch B sells it for like 10 times what he paid oligarch, then you've had an enormous increase in GDP. The problem is like, well, is the country any better off? So GDP, sort of like free trade, is just these are concepts that have all been created as part of the matrix. You know, they're all ways to confuse people into thinking they're in some kind of economic reality that is not just taking them straight into the technologic slave state.
Well, I
But
mean, is the good society quantifiable? Is it all based on how many, gadgets we have and these things? And again, this goes back to the Golden Mean argument, is that there is a value to social stability, and but again, we live in an age where all that has been taught as being backward and retrograde. We need social mobility. We have to be moving every 4 years. On average, the American family moves every 4 years. That is a recipe for social instability, and also atomization is what we have today. Because, but this, everything is geared towards this. We're talk about we have to be like Quicksilver. We have to be mobile, competitive in these things. And this is an example of when they unified the European economies under the currency, under the euro. Did it really make much sense to unify German and German culture with Greek culture? Does anyone know the difference between German and Greek culture? And just because the Greeks like to live a certain way, was that is that somewhat less desirable than the German way? Well, I guess for Germans it's true. Germans like to work a certain way. Greeks like to work a certain way. So do Spaniards like a certain way. But the hubris of the EU means they all have to be unified under one currency block, which is absurd given the different economies and culture of the region. But it is very effective if you have sort of a Judeo-Masonic plan to sort of break down cultures and create sort of a
Right.
homogenous, one world system, which is what they're doing at great
Exactly.
cost.
That was what the real goal was. That all of the economic stuff was all just BS. They had a cultural purpose for this. That's really what was in, that's why they did it, obviously. And so public just has to look in back of the mask. The mask is the workers' paradise. The mask is, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. The mask is, the Disneyland. But in back of it is the technologic slave state.
And it's kind of funny. This is an example where we're citing countries like Hungary, or maybe examples in Poland. They're all former Eastern Bloc countries that the irony, and this is sort of what Hegel called the cunning of reason, and some of us would say it's God's will. But the idea that there's no good idea that the devil can't corrupt, but there's also no evil plot that God can't use for his own purposes. And perhaps the Berlin Wall and the Iron Curtain was just that, because a lot of these Eastern European countries seem to maintain some sort of integralism or cultural identity, which is now fighting back against the New World Order. It's not perfect, but it seems to be more resistance coming from the East to sort of the toxic Masonic Western ideas. And a good example was, I think, last year, Poland, their l legislature passed a law closing stores on Sunday. Now, there was a time in the West when that was sort of routine. You didn't go shopping on Sunday. You had blue so-called blue laws and these things. But that concept is very illiberal, but it's probably culturally healthier. And the fact that their legislature, which re represents the popular will of Polish society, can pass a law reflects that society has a healthier outlook on life in general than perhaps their countries to the west of them.
Indeed.
So,
Well, Tim, that's fascinating.
but that is a suppression of free trade, not letting people go out and shop
Let's
on a
not let,
Sunday.
admit that.
So,
All right,
okay.
brother. We will see you next week. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Joe. I'll see you. Talk to you. Enjoy the rest of the weekend. Bye bye.
Bye-bye.